And I would like to start, first of all, by correcting two errors I made yesterday. They weren't too bad, don't worry. Fortunately, none of my exposition hung heavily on them. But in Matthew 22 and verse 20, Matthew 22, 20, I referred to the word inscription there, or superscription, when he said, whose image and superscription, in the marginal rendering there is inscription, and I said that that word only occurs one other place in the scripture, and that was the Septuagint of Isaiah 44, 5. That is incorrect. The word occurs many other places, well, not many, a few other places in the New and the Old Testament, both. And also I made the statement that Jesus' public ministry had essentially ended when chapter 21 begins, because now we're in the last week and the whole tone of the Gospel of Matthew changes. That is true, but there's one slight exception which you ought to know about. That is verse 14 of chapter 21, when it was in the temple, that it says, the blind and the lame came to him in the temple and he healed them. So there was still this one last act, and I might add is a very significant act. The blind and the lame. Go back to 2 Samuel chapter 5 and you'll get the whole story there. Now, today I will perform a feat that will rival Brother Fidel's 3-minute life of Dr. Thomas, the other night. I'm going to give you a 3-minute exposition of the Olivet Prophecy. To get things in context, of course, as Matthew is such a book of great context, let's just follow through a brief synopsis of the chapters up to the Olivet Prophecy. Let's do that first. Okay, chapter 21 is when Jesus returns to Jerusalem in the last week. He comes to the temple. He finds it filled with evil and wickedness. They have the disputes with the scribes, and the elders, and the chief priests that we talked about yesterday. The two parables that he spoke, and they perceived that he was talking about them when he spoke these parables. And then that brought forth this final confrontation of these four questions. Remember the four questions that came up. You can review those briefly. That the three testing questions by the Pharisees and Herodians and the Sadducees, and then the Pharisees, and finally Jesus asked a real question, whose son am I? This is what came right on the heels of those parables, and this we can see was a totally frustrating experience as far as the Lord being able to really teach someone, perhaps the one lawyer who asked the last question, who said, Master, you have indeed answered right, might have come to some knowledge and repentance at that point. But right after that is Matthew 23, which is the famous chapter of woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Because after this, there's nothing left that he can do anymore but say, woe. The time has passed when he could have hoped that there could have been some salvation in general. Of course, we're not talking the fact that none of them were, because indeed the first ecclesias were filled primarily with scribes and Pharisees. Those were, by and large, the first converts. But compared to how many there should have been of an entire national repentance, this just didn't happen. So judgment was pronounced in chapter 23, the woes on the people as a religious body. And then in chapter 24, now it's the woe on Jerusalem as the capital and the central city of Israel. Now it's the nation itself. So this is the Olivet Prophecy comes now in this sequence. Well, what is the Olivet Prophecy about? It was an answer to three questions by the disciples when Jesus said that not one stone would be left standing in the temple. And they asked three questions about when this would be and what would be the sign of this and of his coming, the sign of the close of the age and his coming. That's in 24 and verse 3. As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will this be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age?" I take that to be three questions. It may only be two. But in any event, he gives an answer. Jesus answers them, and this is how he answers them. Right off the bat, he cautions them about false Christs, false prophets, people who would lead them away, lead them astray. He said, if possible, even the very elect. And this feature shows up in three separate places in the prophecy, verses 4 and 5, then again verse 11, and then finally in verses 23 through 26. It's the first thing he brings their mind to when they say, what will be the sign? What would you look for? He says, watch out. Look out for false Christ, who will say they're a Christ, but they are not. The second of the major features of the prophecy, and I'm not now making any indication of when these things would be. You know, say, do they apply to the destruction in the year 70? Do they apply now? Do they apply both? Is it primarily then and secondarily now? That is not what I'm getting at in this exposition. I'm just trying to show in what terms Jesus answered them. Okay? There was a big section on false Christ. There's a big section on tribulation. I should say there's three sections on false Christ, two big sections on tribulation, about wars, about rumors of wars, about persecution, about famines, about people being put to death. He says, this is part of the answer of what would have to come to pass before his coming. And then the third major feature is that of signs. There will be things to look for. They asked for a sign and said, okay, these are things to look for. And included among those are the sign of the fig tree, the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, the sun and the moon being darkened, the abomination of desolation. He tells them things to look for. In addition, I might add to the first two, which also are signs of a sense, the arising of false Christ and the tribulations. All of these things together are the terms of reference in which Jesus answered the question. Now, that's about all I'm going to say about the Olivet Prophecy. This is something you ought to know. This comprises virtually the entire thing. This is what he talks about. And when you study the prophecy, keep this in mind. But yet there's one more thing that I'll leave that up there so you can copy it for a minute. Turn to the prophecy and look at verse 36. And this is where I'm really going to start this morning's exhortation, because I just wanted to get the whole sequence of events from Matthew 21 clear through the end of the three parables we'll look at and see where we're going. The end of this prophecy, Jesus makes this comment. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Despite all these things that he said would come to pass and the observability of them all, and despite the fact that he is answering their question, and don't ever forget that. They ask him a question, and he is answering it. It may be somewhat enigmatic, but it's an answer. And he was not trying to hide anything from his own disciples. They wanted information about what would be these signs. He said, this is what's going to happen. So there it is. That's our answer. But despite all this, one fundamental thing remains. You still don't know exactly when, and Jesus made a point to make that clear to them. These things are going to come to happen. You'll know that you're in the general territory, perhaps, but still, there is one thing missing. You don't know exactly when, and therefore your preparation for the coming of man is not to be based on the fact that you know when, because you won't know when. And to prove that, or to demonstrate that, he finishes out the prophecy up to verse 44 by exhorting us to watch for something, and then he tells a parable about watchfulness. Now, verse 36 is a turning point in the prophecy, because that's where he really goes from setting down the answer to them to beginning in the exhortation to them of how to be prepared for this event. He says, but of that day and hour no one knows. not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father only. And then perhaps verse 37 to 41, a parenthesis. Nobody knows, but listen to this, he says. It will be like it was in the days of Noah. What were people doing? They were eating and drinking and marrying, giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark. And they did not know until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then he also says, two men will be in the field, one taken, one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one taken and one left. He seems to imply that because nobody knows exactly when, that people would be not expecting it, and they'd be going about their daily business when this event happened. There's some other details in there, of course, but keep that little corpus of information in there, 37 through 41, is perhaps a parenthesis saying there is something to look at, there is something to watch, but exactly when, no, you won't know. You'll know something is going on, but you don't know when. Therefore, your preparation is based on something besides that. This is what we're getting to now. Verse 42, he comes back to the same thing. He says, watch. Therefore, watch. You don't know when. Watch, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. Now, there is a fundamental contradiction here, isn't there? He says, watch, but then he says, you don't know when he's coming. And you're not going to know when he's coming, but he says to watch anyway. Now, does it do any good to watch if you don't know when he's coming? What he's saying is, no matter how much you watch these things around you, these signs I told you, you still don't know when. Well, he proves that by saying this little, you might call it a parable, verse 43, 44. But know this, that if the householder had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have watched and would not have let his house be broken into. The point is, the householder doesn't know when the thief is coming. Nobody knows when the thief is coming. So what must the householder do? He's not going to sit up all night and watch and wait and watch and wait and watch and wait. And then, oh, there he is, there's the thief. What time is it? 3:15. And the thief comes in and plunders his house. Did it do him any good to watch and wait? No. But what would the householder have done if he known a thief was coming at some time? He would be what? Prepared. The house would have been locked. And the thief would not have gotten in the first place. So he says, therefore you must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. In other words, if you're ready at all times, you're always ready. You're always watching. So the question is, watch what? Is it watching the newspaper? Is it watching the Falkland Islands? Is it watching Israel? That's better than the Falkland Islands, I suppose. But the point is this, even if we know from these things exactly when the Lord is coming, will it do us any good if we're not personally prepared? The answer is, watch yourself. Watch your own spiritual development. And this is the point of the next three parables, especially the next parable. If you are ready at all times, you are always ready. And if you're not spiritually set for the coming of Christ, you'll never be ready, even if you know the exact minute of His arrival on this earth. That's the point of it. The knowledge of the time of His coming will not do anyone any good. It'll be just like a man who waits and he says, I know there's a thief coming, and the thief comes and takes everything he has away anyway. So, try to get this in your head. Now, I have a few references there from Deuteronomy, and it's only one place among many in the Old Testament where we have this exhortation to take heed unto yourself and keep the covenant which God gave you. Verse 9, only take heed and keep your soul, keep your life diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. Make them known to your children. Therefore, take good heed to yourselves. Verse 15, and what's the other one? Verse 23, take heed to yourselves, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make a graven image in the form of anything which the Lord your God has forbidden you. For the Lord your God is a devouring fire, a jealous God. And those are just a few passages from Deuteronomy, and you'll find that exhortation many times in the Old Testament. Take good heed to yourself, your own self. What are you watching? You're watching what goes into your mind and what comes out of it. Your spiritual well-being for a person in that position will never be caught surprised. There is no thief in the night for the person who is ready. Verse 44, you must be ready. That word is translated elsewhere, prepared. It's like, might be even in the version I should be reading from. No, the Authorized also has ready, but elsewhere it's translated prepared. Someone who's done their work. So that's the whole point. When you see this word watch, it's watch what? It's watch yourself. Now, Jesus goes on to emphasize this point by telling three parables. The first one is directly in line with this. He tells the parable of servants in the household, virgins waiting for the bridegroom, and servants employed in their master's business. I'll have this up for a little while. You have to scribble it down right now. Now, this first parable, that of the servants in the household, is the one that links the Olivet prophecy, as you remember from the first day how Matthew uses these linking phrases so many times. It links up the Olivet prophecy with these three sets of parables, and then this in turn goes into the next, and the next one is linked to the next. So we have this all as one context where you really can't break it because everything is hooked to each other. The linking idea is here is this idea of watchfulness and what Jesus means by watchfulness. So look at the first parable now, the one servants of the household. Now the title I have up there is called Parables of Judgment. These are parables which I strongly suggest that we look in terms of lessons for us to learn. Jesus has just talked about his coming, and these parables describe what is Jesus going to look for when he comes. I think they are of the utmost value in instruction. If we would really know what is our Lord going to judge us on, what's he going to look for when he looks at us and examines us, as we see in these parables so many times of a man coming, he returns and he inspects what his servants have done, or what his invited guests have done, or what his virgins have done. When Jesus comes to look at us in the eye, or right through our eyes and into our minds and hearts, these are the types of things which he has told us to prepare ourselves in. So let's go through them, these three things. First, this first parable, it extends from verse 45 of Matthew 24, and it ends at the end of the chapter. It's a fairly brief parable. But it talks about two servants. One is a faithful and wise servant. The other is an evil servant, or a wicked servant. The first one was set over his master's house, and his job was to give them food at their proper time. Verse 46 says, "Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Truly, I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions." When his master comes, he will be doing it. He's in the act of caring for the master's household and giving him their food. But if that wicked servant, or that evil servant, says to himself, "My master is delayed," and begins to beat his fellow servants and eats and drinks with the drunken, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, a day when he doesn't know, and at an hour he doesn't know, and will punish him, or will literally cut him in pieces. Cut him asunder is the Authorized reading, and the Marge says cut him off. It really means to cut him in two. And you might think of the two-edged sword there. cut a person in two, dividing to the joints of his marrow, joints and marrow. And in any event, this servant is cut off, and he is consigned with a hypocrite where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, what's the difference between these two fellows? One was diligently doing his duty. The other one was doing two things wrong. One, he was smiting his fellow servants, and two, he was eating and drinking with the drunken. He was not caring for the household. He was rather tearing down the household, and moreover, he was indulging in the vices of the world. The wise and faithful servant was in the process of his service at the time of the coming of his master, whereas the other one was neglecting his duties and was coming at a time when he did not know. And this is the whole point, isn't it? That when somebody is neglecting their spiritual duties and their care in the household, it'll always be a time they don't know. It doesn't make any difference what they might know about prophecy, even if that could tell them the exact day or hour. But if you're not doing what the master has assigned you to do, when Jesus comes, it will be at a day when you don't know and you don't expect, because he will be unprepared. He will not have been watching. He had not taken heed unto himself. He was eating and drinking with the drunken. And that's the difference. The faithful servant didn't know when his master was going to come. He didn't know the day or the hour, but when he did come, he was ready. Why was he ready? He was doing what God had assigned him to do. He was doing his master's business, and he was caring for the household. Now, when we get through all three of these things, I'll set out in order what I believe are the teachings of all of them. But this first one is two things to remember about it. One, it's most closely connected to the parable itself, and it connects this idea of watchfulness. And what does watchfulness really mean? It's taking heed to yourself. If you're doing what God appoints you to do, you're always ready. Therefore, you must be ready, because the Son of Man is coming an hour you don't expect. You don't know when he's coming, but if you're ready, you're ready no matter when he comes. And if you're not doing your business right, you'll never be ready. Well, after that, Jesus passes on to a consideration of 10 virgins waiting for a bridegroom. He says, "Then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10 virgins, which took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom." And I want you to listen to these people, because this tale of these 10 virgins, carefully, because we have a lesson here, two or three more lessons, which are extremely sobering. You might want to call this the parable of second place, as well as parable of the virgins. So what do? We have 10 of them, and they all go forth to meet the bridegroom, but verse 2 describes this group. 5 are wise and 5 are foolish. They that were foolish took their lamps, but took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. So they took lamps, but one group took extra oil in a little flask. Now, while the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. At midnight there was a cry made, "Behold, the bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him." Then all the virgins arose and trimmed their lamps, as they all got them burning. And the foolish said unto the wise, "Give us oil, for our lamps are going out." I think is the more sensible reading following the margin there. The lamps weren't gone out, they were going out. But the wise answered, saying, "Not so, lest there not be enough for us and you, but go ye rather to them that sell and buy for yourselves." So the foolish went to buy some more oil. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came at an hour they didn't expect. And they that were ready, that same word that's from verse 44, the Son of Man, you must be ready. That's verse 44 of the preceding chapter, where Jesus said, "Therefore you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." And that's exactly what happens in this parable. The bridegroom comes at an hour they didn't expect. He comes at midnight. Now, I've heard of weddings at 5 o'clock in the morning, but not at midnight. He comes at an hour they don't expect. Some are ready, and some aren't. So what happens to them? They that were ready, were prepared, went in with him to the marriage, and the door was shut. you might, as you wake up, to think about the ark. Jesus referred to the ark just a few minutes ago when he talked about the days of Noah and some people going into the ark, and God shut the door. And that was it. The world was condemned when God shut the door. Same thing here. The door was shut. Afterward, also the other virgin saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." And you can maybe imagine the people saying, "Noah, open to us. It's getting cloudy." But he said, "Verily I say unto you, I don't know you. I know you not. Watch therefore, for ye know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh." And we have that phrase repeated one more time. Watch. Be prepared to yourself. Watch yourself. And then you won't have to worry about when the time is, because you'll always be ready. Now, I want you to take a good look at these 10 virgins. Okay? I want you to note carefully can't really tell if that's as best I can do or not on the focus. But they all had lamps. You got that straight? 5 are wise and 5 are foolish, but even the foolish ones took their lamps. They all went out to meet the bridegroom, even the foolish ones. They all had oil in their lamps. Even the foolish had oil in their lamps. They all slumbered and slept. Even the wise and foolish together, they all slumbered and slept. When the cry came, "The bridegroom comes," what do? They all woke up. The foolish didn't just roll over in bed and say, "Don't bother me." They arose, and they trimmed their lamps. They all did that together. But remember, the one difference was that the foolish didn't bring this extra little flask of oil to keep their lamps burning, so they had to go buy some more. And what happened while they were gone? Right, the door was shut. And that was it. Now, you'd think that these 5 foolish virgins should at least get, as I said, a second prize. You know, they came pretty close, didn't they? They did everything that the wise did. Right down the line. I guess that's... Right down the line, they did everything the wise people did. Except what? When the Son of Man came, they weren't ready. They weren't quite ready. They didn't have that extra little foresight that it took to say, maybe I better do something a little more. Maybe I better be prepared for anything that might happen. The wise were prepared. They were thoughtful and mature enough to look ahead to unforeseen circumstances down the road that might cause some problems. They were ready. Under any circumstance, they were ready. And that's the difference between wise and foolish. And it's not much, is it, apparently? It doesn't look like much, but there was no second place for these virgins. "I never knew you. Be gone. I don't know you." That's all they got. "I don't know you." As I said, that's pretty sobering. There isn't any second place in the kingdom. You're in or you're out. And that extra preparation, and when we summarize these whole things, all three together, we'll look at that again. Now, I'd like to look at the last parable before I come back to all three of these. So we're going to look at a little bit of detail in all three of them, for each of them, and then look at them all as one. The last parable is this one, the parable of the 10 talents, which I have written on the overhead, servants employed in their master's business. In my view, a slightly more appropriate title. Well, let's look at some of the details in here. Jesus tells one more parable, number 3 in this set of things to look for our preparation for our meeting with him at the judgment. "For it will be as," we're in chapter 25 and verse 14, the authorized, you see, has for the kingdom of heaven, it's all in italics, but it is another parable of the kingdom. For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1. Every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Or the Revised Standard Version says, each according to his ability. Now I want to stop here for a minute and determine what this word ability means. Or what this, this whole passage means. They get talents according to some ability they have, or capability, or power. Whatever is in their power to do. This is where you have to be careful, because sometimes it's easy to get thrown by the word talent. This word talent, although it is etymologically related and is a root of our English word talent, that is a skill, in this usage here has nothing to do with talent. It is, in this usage, a title of a Greek coin, okay? Evidently, the word originally means something that's measured out, and that's why it could apply to a coin or apply to somebody's skill. But in any event, these 5 talents don't apply to skills. They apply to a measure of something. And the reason we know this is because the talents are given according to their abilities, according to their skill, according to their capability or power to do something. So each person has some ability, which of course God gives us too, and then in accordance with that power we have to do His work, we are given something called talents, which represents something. And I would suggest that most likely what they represent are responsibilities. And responsibility means a response to your ability. This is exactly what's going on in the parable. They have an ability, and they're giving something in accordance to that. What responds to our ability? It's called responsibility. Now, I don't know if the word responsibility has anything to do with the suggested etymology there. That may be something entirely fictitious, but it's a good way to remember what the word responsibility means. We all have responsibilities in God's house. It's how we respond to our own abilities. That's what God expects out of us. And this is the point of the parable. How do people respond to the abilities which they do have? Well, if God gives somebody twice as much ability, then He expects twice as much out of them. So 3 people are considered. One is given 5 talents, 1 2, and 1 1. They are given work to do, or perhaps opportunities to do work in accordance with the abilities they have. Well, you know what happens. The man who makes 5 goes out and makes 5 more. He increases what he has and finds even more things to do and is diligent in his master's service. And I might add, nowhere in the parable does the master even instruct him to do anything. He just says, here's your money. Here's my money, I should say, he says, because it's the master's money. Here's my money. I'm going away. But they take the initiative. Maybe it's implied that they were supposed to trade with it, but it might be part of the parable that it's the initiative of these people. They went and they doubled the master's money while he was gone. They found more to do, as we interpret the parable, in accordance with their ability. Well, I don't think it's at all insignificant that we have the following pattern. The man who is given much does good work in his master's service. And when the master comes back, his response to this man will pick up again in verse 19. After a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh and reckoneth with them. And I say, how typical is the parables that Jesus told, which are recorded in Matthew. I've said it many times, but I want to point out again. Here comes the master. The picture of Jesus as a judge is so strong in this gospel. And these 3 parables, by the way, are not in any of the other gospels. They're peculiar to Matthew. So the Lord of those servants comes and reckons with them. And he's going to come back and he's going to see what has gone on in his household. So he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliveredst unto me. Read the RSV. Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here I have made 5 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And he also who had the 2 talents came forward, saying, Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here I have made 2 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. The first 2 did good and faithful service. But now the last one comes, and he did not turn his 1 talent into 2. His 1 talent remained 1. Remember, he didn't lose it. It was still there. But he doesn't get a second prize for keeping what he had. His condemnation comes because he didn't do good and faithful service. Instead, he comes forth with an excuse. And he says, He also who had received the 1 talent came forward, saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not winnow. So I was afraid. Not afraid of the master, afraid of losing his money, I would suggest. Maybe take a moment here to explain this phrase, I knew you to be a hard man. We usually associate that to mean, I knew you to be an unjust man, and you take other people's goods, and you take, you gather other people's sowing. I don't think at all what he's saying there. Rather, I would suggest to you this idea. Master, I knew you to be an extraordinarily capable person. The word hard in itself does not have any connotation, good or bad. It means hard. Well, possibly it could mean, I knew you to be a man who didn't need my help. You gather where you don't even winnow. You reap where you don't even sow. You don't need my help. You don't need my help at all. I didn't want to lose your money, so I hid it. I was afraid of losing what you gave me. You didn't really need my help. Now that is an attitude which we have to contend to. And as I said before, it's not insignificant that the man who had a lot knew he had a lot and went out and did his work. And the man to whom the Lord gave a middle level of responsibilities and a middle level of abilities to do them, he knew what he had to do and he did it. But this is what, to me, makes this parable so alive and so real and so incisive of human nature. It's the people who really don't think they have much. And maybe they don't. Maybe they are, in fact, less capable brethren, because the body is going to have a variety of people. But it's those people who are the most likely to say, God doesn't need me. He's a hard man. He can do what he wants. God, if God wants something done, he'll get it done. He doesn't need my help. And I'll just sit in my corner and try to take care of what I have and not mess my life up and mess up the ecclesia. That's a real attitude. Is this cowardly and fearful person who thought that God really didn't need him. Well, God does need help. He wants people to do his work. And he doesn't tell parables about servants for nothing. These are people in service to their master. They're servants. They're doing his work. So I suggest anyway that this parable is really, in one interpretation, very much directed to knowing our master. We'll look at that a little more when we compare the 3 together. In any event, what happens to this fellow? He is afraid. He is fearful. He says, well, here you have what's your own. And his master answers him, you wicked and slothful servant. You knew that I reap where I have not sowed or gather when I have not winnowed. You knew that I was a person of such power as this. Oh, sure, God could do that if he wanted to. Of course God has the power to do that. But still, he gives us into our hands the work that he has given us. Well, you should have at least invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have received what was my own with interest. And then the talent taken from him, who has the 10, for every one who has will more be given, and he will have abundance. But from him who has not, and I suggest that has not there is an understanding of his master, and we'll look at that real closely in a minute. Even that what he has is taken away. But this is the whole point of the parable in verse 30. Cast the unprofitable or the worthless servant into outer darkness, from where their men will weep and gnash their teeth. And that is, we've seen many times before, and once before in the first parable. So those are the three parables. Now we'll look at all of them together. And the first thing I'd like you to look at is just the terminology used. Just the terminology. There's two parables about servants, and there's one parable of virgins. So right away, you know he's talking about the judgment of the household, because nobody else can be described as God's servants or God's virgin except his household. Now, in the parable of the servants, we have a wicked servant and contrasted to a servant called faithful and wise. Remember, the wicked is the one who went out drinking and getting drunk and beating his fellow servants. The faithful and wise was the one who was found feeding his house. In the parable of the virgins, two classes, one called foolish, one called wise. The wise were ones who were prepared for any event. And in the last parable of the servants, we have the, on the left-hand side, a servant designated as wicked, slothful, and worthless. I chose worthless there rather than profitable. That seems to be the choice of most versions, and in my view, the best understanding of the word. Worthless, absolutely no worth whatsoever. Not just unprofitable, but completely worthless. Of no value to his creator, because he didn't think he could do anything for his God. And on the contrast, you have a good and faithful man who was employed in his master's service. That's the terminology. Now, let's look at the lessons from each of these. And here, I put forth these three with two prefaces. One, the conviction to know that when we're talking about, you know, parables and interpretations of things, I'm interpreting, right? I'm giving you my best ideas about what I think these things mean. Now, I could be wrong, as anybody else could. On the other hand, these are extremely important, perhaps the most important parables in all of the sayings of Jesus, because they are right at the time of his coming. These are things on which we will be judged. So the suggestions I put forth are, I think, important. So I hope they're right, because it's a very serious issue we're getting to right now. Very serious indeed. Okay, what about the first parable? Servants in the household. I suggest the meaning is along these lines. One is, we have the idea of service to the brotherhood. That seems obvious. This is the format. This is the framework. This is the literary structure, if you want to go so far as to say literary for something that only takes four verses. But this is the structure of the thing. It's people working in God's house and taking care of their brothers, or not taking care of their brothers. So service to the brotherhood is an important feature of Jesus' judgment of our walk in this life. And also it's the dedication, the self-sacrifice at all times. As you remember, this is the one that has to do with the watchfulness. Watch. You don't know when he's coming. If you're always doing God's will, then you'll always be ready. Now consider this fact. Our daily life. If we knew Jesus for certain to show up today, would you live any differently than you would if you knew he wasn't going to come for 10 years? You probably would, but you shouldn't, right? Every day should be a day lived in expectation of the Master. Every day. And even if you knew Jesus weren't going to come in your lifetime, would you change your daily life? Of course you wouldn't. if you were a spiritually minded brother, you'd still do the same things day in and day out, and you'd always be ready. So our service is not dependent on when he's going to come. Oh, I have 3 years to get ready. No, it's not. It's today. Today, 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 today. Every day is a today until the Lord comes. It's dedication, it's self-sacrifice at all times. That person is always ready. And also the idea of service to the brotherhood. Okay, next one. The servants are now turned into virgins, or I should say he shifts from servants to virgins, and not people doing his service, but people waiting. They're not doing anything active, especially, but they're waiting. And some people are ready and some aren't. Some people have some more foresight, some more maturity, some more self-control, preparation, growth, farsightedness. They're all synonyms with a little different flavor. But this is the idea here. The only thing that separated the foolish from the wise were ready. They just had enough sense, enough self-control to say, what's going to happen in my life in the future? I'm going to be ready no matter what comes. And there's an extremely important lesson in preparation here. An extremely important lesson. We cannot meet adversity when adversity comes. It's too late. When the bridegroom comes, you can't go and get ready. When trouble comes, you can't go and get ready. You have to do your preparation beforehand. I've said this many times, and I'll continue to say it. The time for you to prepare yourself for every day is in the morning. The first thing you do when you wake up, you have to prepare yourself for the troubles of that day before you go out and mess it up. And that's going to happen within 3 minutes when you get out of bed, probably. You can wake up and run into something, somebody said you're walking to a table and already you've lost your temper and you've gotten mad, you can't find the toothbrush, and you get out of bed, it's too late, you're upset, you're angry already. You can shoot your day right at the beginning. You have to prepare when you're in a spiritual frame of mind. Get ready. It's a daily basis, it's a weekly basis, it's a yearly thing. Prepare now. You know what the future is going to bring. If there is a future, it's not going to be an easy one. It's going to be tough. There are going to be tribulations and so forth. Prepare now. It's too late. When the trouble comes, when the time comes, you can't, oh, go buy some oil. It won't work. It won't work. You prepare. You look ahead. In a short phrase, it's action. It's spiritual action rather than sinful reaction to our daily problems. Spiritual action rather than sinful reaction. If you prepare, if you look ahead and say, I know this is going to come, when it comes, I'll be ready. Then you'll be a wise virgin. One more thing I would like to say about these first two parables is this. In the first parable, this will explain one detail in the parable of the virgins. There was a strong exhortation to be feeding the household and to do everything you can to help your brother in his walk to the kingdom. But in this parable of the virgins, we have this perhaps somewhat dark saying, when the foolish say, give us some of your oil, our lamps are going out. And the wise replied, well, perhaps there won't be enough for us and you. Go buy some. That wasn't very nice, was it? And go buy some. Go buy your own. How does that compare to the first one where you're supposed to, you know, prepare to feed your brotherhood? Why didn't they bring some extra oil and say, oh, here's some oil. Here, I have some for you too. These two parables are told together to make this point clear. You can't develop maturity in somebody else. You cannot develop somebody else's fruit of their spirit. You can feed them, but their growth comes from their own heart and their own application. Had the wise people given them oil, that really wouldn't have helped anything. They would have had some oil, but they didn't have the heart and the mind to be prepared. You can't get your brother into the kingdom, is what it's saying. You can help them, you can exhort them, you can do a lot, but you can't give them oil when it's too late. If they don't develop something for themselves, that's it. The last parable combines certain aspects of the first two. First, we have the idea of servants again, but these servants are not judged in accordance to what they do with their brother. It's what they do with their master's goods. They're servants in a household, but the other servants aren't mentioned, the ones whom they feed and drink. So the idea here is we have that, plus the maturity, the self-dedication, the preparation to know that when the master says you've got abilities and I want you to respond to those abilities and do things for me in my service, then they do it. And they've grown up enough to do it. That's so part of this parable combines aspects of the first two. But the third aspect is perhaps the one that's most important. I said knowing our master. Because the man who was rejected was the one who didn't know his master. He thought he did, but he didn't. He had a total misconcept of what God really wanted out of him. And he thought that God didn't need his work and that he could stay in the ecclesial closet and still come to the judgment seat and be accepted. Well, he wasn't. So this one, perhaps the main thrust is knowing who we're working with, intimately knowing our master. And then all these other things fall in line. So that's my suggestions on these three parables of how we can prepare ourselves for what Christ will be looking for in us. Our relationship to our brothers and sisters, our personal maturity and self-control, and knowing to whom we are in servitude at this time, and using every aspect of our ability to respond to His to what we've given us and use them in the service of His household. These three parables of judgment, then, are perhaps the last word that Jesus has to us concerning this matter of, you know, all of gospel teaching. It ends with this. And I don't think it ends with this for any small reason. They're in parables. They're for us to search out and to learn. But yet, they're not without the lessons, and the lessons, I believe, are there. Well, inasmuch now as we have looked towards a bit of the life and teaching of our Master in this gospel and have concluded with some consideration of the coming of Jesus, I would like to close this class by singing two hymns, and then we'll have a short prayer. Hymn number 219, "The days are quickly flying and Christ will come again." And after we sing that one, I would like to sing again hymn 308. I believe it was used last night at the program, but I had it prepared for this, and I think it's still appropriate. It's appropriate every day. These are the last words of the speaker last night. They're exactly the meaning of the lesson of these parables. Shall we be there when Christ comes in His kingdom? We make the answer now. Watch. Take heed unto yourselves. Be ready by doing the Master's will every day. In 219, then 308, and a short prayer.
Amen. gracious and holy Father in heaven, it is now with extreme thanks that we approach you in prayer through Jesus our Lord, that you've given us the story of his life, and you allow us to have it, to study it, and to read it daily. We ask that you continue to bless our studies and bless our lives to the end that we will know you and know Jesus better from having been here, and to each day draw closer to you and draw closer to the ideal of service and worship and maturity and self-control that you would desire of us. We pray, Father, for your blessing on all the household in this matter, to make us one body of good and faithful servants and of wise virgins, each day doing our part and each day preparing ourselves for your coming. May that day come soon, Father, today if it be your will, to vindicate your name and the suffering of Jesus your Son, of your truth in this earth, to restore